You're listening to Face Off, episode 93, recorded November 1st, 2010. This episode of Face Off is brought to you by AgileTask. AgileTask is a task tracking application featuring an agile workflow, tagging for organization and achievements. AgileTask, your lightweight personal backlog tool. Check it out by going to agiletask.me. And RocketShipIt. RocketShipIt, the complete web-based multi-carrier shipping solution for small businesses and developers. Shipping rates, integrated tracking, and labels for UPS, FedEx, and USPS shippers. RocketShipIt is shipping made easy. Go to rocketshipit.it. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm the other one, Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we talk about various aspects of web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. That's where you get all the cool stuff, all the links, all the things we talk about. You can, if you really want to be picky, you can get the times for each section so that you can skip to it if you want.
Yeah, if you want to just skip over Jade's, you know, news and follow-ups or
his
wacky geek tools.
Hey now.
No, you're not going to want to skip over that stuff. That's good stuff. But
that's how much we care about our listeners, is we get the times. We listen to the show. We get the times of each segment so that you can, if you want. Because, I mean, think about it. We were thinking about this, one of the things. We can't afford a transcription service. It'd be great to get the show transcribed because it helps, you know, with search engine stuff. But, one of the things we do is we post our show notes, and then we try and post times so that, you know, like oftentimes if we talk about someone's product in the web apps, I mean, it's kind of rude to expect them to search through it. And we really want to facilitate people, if they're interested in one section, being able to go to that and not leaving, and then they can go to that section, listen to it. And then I'm very certain that after listening to that segment, they'll go, you know, I should listen to the rest of the show.
Or let's say your commute's only 15 minutes. So you can skip right onto the topic and listen to that, or... You know, if you're interested in the web app section, you can skip to that part.
Yeah, exactly. So let's, speaking of, let's get into our news and follow-ups this week. Our first one is a news item that it just shows that Twitter is getting picky about the word Twitter and tweet.
What do you mean picky?
Well,
can we not use it anymore?
Well, they put out rules about how you should use the word. You know, make sure if you meant it, so quote, make sure if mentioning tweet, you include a direct reference to Twitter. For instance, tweet with Twitter, or display Twitter marks with the mention of tweet. You know, or naming your application or product, or applying for a domain, use tweet in the name of your application only if it's designated to be used exclusively with the Twitter platform. Don't use tweet in the name of your application if it is used with any other platform. So things like TweetDeck, which have Facebook integration and stuff, no, can't do it anymore.
So are they saying TweetDeck, they needed to change their name?
I don't know if they have to change their name or what. They don't really say how this is being enforced. I mean, I'm assuming one thing they do is revoke your API access.
It is saying they're emphasizing on the capital letters, so maybe TweetDeck without the capital T is okay.
Well, that's kind of what they're saying is, you know, if you, especially Twitter says they're trying, because, I mean, the word Twitter and the word tweet are words in the English language, right? I mean, if I was, you know, if I made a soundboard with bird tweets on it, I mean, I could call it like, you know, tweet board or something like that. And Twitter really should have no say in it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I don't think like that, in that sense, they clearly couldn't go, you know, they couldn't take legal action, but... You know, it just shows, again, I think it's building your business 100% on a platform is where it starts getting scary, because oftentimes when they're young, like Twitter, you know, they want integration as much as possible. Use Twitter everywhere. It's cool. We're cool. We're young. We're cool. We're hip. You know, make a Twitter thing for us. And then after a while, they get popular. You know, they start turning into, you know, I'm using air quotes here, the man. And, you know, then all the bad stuff happens where it's like all of a sudden like, what? I can't use the word tweet in my name if I integrate with Facebook, even though they're both social platforms?
I don't know. The Webster Dictionary is saying that Twitter, even the word Twitter, spelled exactly how their site is called, is to utter successive chirping noises or to talk in a chattering fashion.
Exactly, yeah.
It's in the Webster Dictionary. So even the word Twitter...
Yeah, I mean, my heart, you know, it's all the Twitter. I've heard that before. But, yeah, so. You know, who knows? But It just shows that, you know, they start, this is, you know, a cycle that we see pretty often. They're really hip and cool. And then they, as they get popular, they start, you know, getting a little more corporate, wanting to protect their name and stuff like that. So watch out. This article is interesting because they're saying that they're like, the one line in the at the bottom of this article is, we urge you to rethink this on Twitter.
Yeah, it seems like kind of a weird move here.
Yeah. So not happy about that, Twitter. You need to change that. The next news and follow-up we want to talk about, and I have a specific reason I kind of want to talk to you about this, is that the web service Dropio, drop.io, got acquired by Facebook, which is, you know, sort of no big deal. There's a lot of acquisitions happening. A lot of these companies have cash on hand that they're going to spend on acquisitions. So it's really not that, you know, crazy of a thing. But the thing that interests me about this is Dropio, they are dropping their service. The Dropio service will exist no more. Users are getting sort of like canned. Within 2 months, it's going to be gone. And I mean, so we were talking about this. I mean, Mark, it's funny because we kind of got, I think it's funny that I'm sure they got a lot of money for it. But at the same time, it kind of makes me a little sad for the state of web apps where, again, I don't like the idea of building an app just to get acquired. And I don't know if these guys did that, but like it feels that way because they got acquired and they're sort of just basically, you know, dropping their users and saying, get out. It was really no warning.
Yeah. I mean, if I was a Dropio user and I was a paid user and I was really happy with the service, I'd be kind of disappointed that they just dropped us off and, you know, they didn't try to work out a deal with Facebook to say, how can we keep it running? On the other hand, if I was offered, you know, a lot of money, I don't know, you know, we don't know what they got. But if I was offered a lot and they said, well, you know what, we really are not interested in the service. We just want the developer and the technology behind it. I don't know. It'd be hard to be put in that situation, but I could see that, you know, I could see myself saying, you know, not, you know, screw the user, but I don't know. Because I don't know.
I would have a really hard time with this because usually if you do something like this, you're probably signing away something that you can't go make like a, you know, basically a duplicate product. You know, you usually sign away your rights to this sort of product, you know, non-compete agreements. And the truth is, I mean, I think I would really want to fight for my users. I guess I don't know their user base or really their culture. I wasn't a Dropio user. But I don't know. It's I guess if I was put in a situation where they said, listen, $100 million for your thing, and I said, well, listen, can we drop it to like $80 million and I can still, you know, keep the service going and help my users or something, you know? And they said, no, deal breaker, $100 million, take it or leave it. That would be a very hard choice. But I mean, I just don't like the feeling of this sort of, you know, like I really like what they did with what Google did with Jaiku. You know, where they're like, listen, people, it's, you know, we bought it, but let's open source it. You know, we'll release it as open source. The community can take care of itself. If you really are interested in the underlying technology, or Etherpad's another great example that they did, you know, if you really are interested in only the underlying technology, then really you should have no problem open sourcing it, right?
Yeah.
I guess if you're interested in the underlying technology, open sourcing it is probably the opposite of what you want to do. Never mind. I may take that back.
The thing is, if this thing is really popular, some programmers out there got to be thinking to themselves, hey, let's make another one. Let's make an open source one, or, you know, let's make one and make it free and we don't, you know,
right.
Let's replace it with something.
Yeah.
That happens. What was it? Etherpad. Was it Etherpad? No, Google open sourced that.
Right. Google open sourced Etherpad. I can't. But, you know, it's something to think about. I think, you know, I don't know. The truth is I don't really like the idea of building businesses to get acquired. It's true. I say, you know, you never know. But I don't like the idea of building big businesses that get acquired for lots of money and then dropping your users and sort of integrating it. It's just not, it's not my thing. I think I would have a hard time with it anyways. I think probably the word on the street, you know, quote unquote, would be that I probably wouldn't sell.
Even for $100 million?
Well, that's why I'm saying never say never. That would be really tough, right? But I don't know. I guess even, let me say, their blog post on this doesn't seem super apologetic, right? Even if, you know, if I, you know, and I said, listen, guys, you know, I'd have to say, listen to my users. I'm very sorry to do this to you. It was a lot of money, straight up. You know, a lot of money is a lot of money. I really didn't want, I tried as hard as I could to get the service to continue, but, you know, and that depends, but like on the agreement, but you know, I would really try and convey as much as possible that I'm really sad to shut down these users, but don't worry, you know, this service will be, you know, resurrected somehow in like Facebook services or Google services. So stay tuned, you know, and I didn't really get that sense from their email or their blog.
Yeah, I agree with you. Their blog post could have been a lot more sympathetic.
It seemed very businessy.
They basically said one of our users is leaving, you know, and the rest are gone if they even have right. more than one. And the service will be shut down and the paid users will continue to work for another month, but then they'll be shut down as well.
I tell you what though, actually, if it was about getting acquired by Facebook, I would have serious reservations, and I could almost guarantee you more often than not, I probably would not sell. I do not like Facebook, and I would not put either my employees or my users in the position to have to integrate with Facebook, especially my employees. I would try and find something else or anything, but I'm not a fan of Facebook, the company. So, all right. Wow. That was rant. I didn't mean to get that so rantish. It was just more started as a light discussion. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. So I saw this on a blog. I think it's a really cool concept. I'm one of those people, I float with the amount of keys I have depending upon where I work on campus. That, you know, sometimes I get a lot of keys, sometimes I don't get many. This is the cable lock key ring. And what's cool about this is the key ring that is just a little bit of cable with like a screw connector so that you can connect it. You know, it's nice because you can like put it on your bag really quick, or it's not a stiff key ring. Like whenever I have to take a key off, like to give to my wife or something, like it hurts. It's hard. It's hard to open the key rings, and like you have to like wedge your fingernail in there. And I'll use the word particular about my keys. They have to be in a particular order on the key ring, and all the keys, like jagged edges, have to be facing the same way, which is always like, it takes like more thinking than it should on a regular key ring. But check this out. It's like you can get, the price came down 99 cents on Amazon.com. You can get these little cable key rings. I think they're pretty cool.
So this one's am I reading that right? 6-inch?
Yeah.
6-inch.
Wait, where are you reading this at?
The big yellow square on the green, the image.
Oh, wow. That's a big one.
That's 6-inch.
6 inches.
Technical details.
So it's 6-inch, but 6-inch in circumference.
Yeah, that's right? A lot, I guess.
6-inch circumference is not a lot. What do you think? Like, I bet you. Let me look. I'm getting it out. All right. That's come on. So let me look. Like 1, 2, 3. So my keyring's probably 4 inches circumference.
Okay, so these are quick. You just pull it apart, basically. You twist it and pull it apart.
Yeah, it basically has like a little screw on one end and kind of a nut on the other, and that's how you secure it back together.
So this is pretty cool. I mean, you can hook it to your bag, like you said.
I've heard them called mechanics key rings, I think.
Is there any issues with it coming apart?
I read one review where a guy said that did happen to him, and what he did was put a drop of nail polish or thread lock or thread tight or whatever on it, and it fixed it. But other than that, I didn't hear any other complaints.
Cool. 99 cents. Can't beat that.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys. I hate bulky things in my pocket, and it sounds weird, but you know, a key ring, it's a stiff thing inside your pocket, so it adds bulk. I always have a hard time because you know, I love my Droid, but really it's a big rectangle brick, you know, in your pocket.
Yeah.
And then same thing with my keys. And I usually carry a pocket knife, and the pocket knife always somehow gets like wedged sideways, which like makes your pants even more, you know, uncomfortable. And you know what? I give anything to put my wallet in my front pockets, but I have my keys and my pocket knife in one and then my cell phone in the other. It's like, where do you put your wallet? But I hate having my wallet in my back pocket, but it's the only pocket I got left.
And then, I mean, then otherwise, you know, the only other pocket for your keys is your front pocket. So then it'll scratch up your Droid.
Right. Yeah. You can't do that. That's just ludicrous. What do you guys do? Listen, I'm, if you listen to the show, what do you put in each pocket, and what pockets do you use? Do you get annoyed by having a wallet in your back pocket? Cause I do. It drives me nuts. Let us know.
For a while there, I was carrying the iPod Touch and the Droid for a while. Cause I was hooked on the iPod
that's
Touch.
Crazy.
Then I, Droid got me out of that one. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff to be carrying around.
Yeah.
It's getting more and more.
And I don't like working like a place cool enough. Like this, I think this is why a lot of people wear like dress jackets or like blazers, you know, because then you get extra pockets for all that cool stuff. But, you know, I don't really have a need for one where I work. That would be sort of considered overkill.
Yeah.
Let us know. Well, I want to know what you guys do for your pockets. So go to twitter.com/faceoffshow. Tweet us out your configuration. Let's move in. Let's move on to our web app. So, you know, that's, you know, you almost talked me out of this. You almost talked me out of this keyring mark. It's cool. You know, 99 cents. Can't really go wrong. Might as well try it out, right?
I have a tendency to sound negative.
You are stuff. You are Captain Naysay. You naysay.
I'm just trying to be logical about everything and you know. Yeah. Ask you questions.
Yeah, you're no fun. You know, I get excited about gadgets. Well, as we know, I spend a lot of money, more money than I should, on gadgets and goofy crap like this. So but I think
it's like once a week or so, I have to talk you out of buying a flashlight or a mouse.
Oh, shut up. All right. Let's move on to our web apps. Our first web app this week is visualizing.org. This is a really cool website. I love visualizations like DataViz, you know, like Mint. If you go to the Mint blog, they always have awesome money visualizations. They really get you pumped. This is a website where people... What's really cool about it is they post their visualizations, but they also post data sources for visualizations if you want to do them yourself, like if you want to graph your own data and stuff. So you can go to the section where you say get data, like if you're interested in getting data so you can play around with it yourself. They have all different kinds of data, like, you know, sea level rising levels, global tuberculosis treatment and prevalence. Like this data set is a CSV, so it's easy data to get to, easy stuff to play around with. You can play with it programmatically if you want in your app. You know, or you can use your traditional sort of visualization tools or whatever to make a viz out of it. But I mean, I like just data like that. But then I also like the visualization. So you can browse, like, this is a really cool one. Where was it at? There's all kinds out there.
A lot of problems, you know, you start hearing numbers and stuff and you kind of, some people like me, I can't visualize large numbers very well. Like, you know, can you visualize $1 billion? $1 billion?
No.
It's actually 7 pallets of $100 bills stacked.
Yeah.
7 pallets.
That's crazy.
You know, it's stuff like that that you just kind of, oh yeah, Facebook was acquired this other company for $1 billion. That's 7 pallets of $100 bills. It's crazy.
Yeah, so I mean, in general, it talks about visualizations in general. Like, this is a cool one. It's just sort of a distribution, a histogram of the results of throwing 3 6-sided dice. You know, and it makes sort of a traditional bell curve. But you know, it's just like it's a cool way to look at it. It took me a bit. I was like, oh yeah, 3D6. That's cool. Visualizing really can help you.
Images, or can they be interactive things?
I'm not sure on this site. I haven't seen an interactive one yet. For now, it's mostly just static ones. I think that's kind of the way the site works. It's like upload your visualization of. Oh, wait a minute. No, you know, I think it's just like upload your picture, upload your visualization, and then talk about it. But
well, they also have data that you can pull down with an API, correct?
I don't know if there is an API, but you can just go. Click get data. It's a REST API in the sense that, yeah, it works in a web browser. but you can get the data and then get various data sets but just by clicking and downloading them.
Okay, so maybe these are visualizations of the data sets that they've provided?
I don't think so. I think it's just in general. I'm trying to think. I thought there was a way to go to a data set and see the visualizations that came from that data set, but I'm not seeing it unless none have happened.
The CDC puts out a lot of data.
Yeah, they do, which is cool because guess what? We get to use it. We own that data.
It's right? Great.
Any data generated through public funds is data we own, and we should be able to play around with it, mine with it, and do whatever we want with it.
Figure out what's going on and visualize it so we don't just hear numbers and say, oh, yeah,
Right. That's, I mean, well, you know, visualizations, they can fall into the same sort of pitfalls as other things where it seems, you know, too good to be true and whatnot. But, you know, I think it's usually a good way to see things because oftentimes it's just data is a lot easier to get a quick understanding through visualization. So check it out at visualizing.org. Our next web app is called Clout, KLOUT.com. Really quick, this one is just basically it's how you can look at your influence on Twitter. So let's go to Jay Robbins. Get my clout score. My clout score is 12, which means I don't have a lot of clout. But what's cool about it below is you can see sort of the clout classification graph, which is like it's like listening versus participating and sharing and creating. It's, you know, a sort of four-way graph. You can see some of the things that you're really strong at, what you're good at. I'm a specialist, so I may not be a celebrity, but within my area of expertise, my opinion is second to none. That's right. That's right, clout. Tell me about it. And then I can also see the people I'm influenced by, which I'm not sure how they get this. I think it's sort of basically by who you reply and who replies back to you. Like, I reply a lot to Mark Sanborn and Gary Vaynerchuk, so I'm clearly, you know, influenced by them. I think, you know, some of these people below have replied back to me. So that means I influence them, I think, is kind of how it decides it. And then you can see your content analysis. Like, apparently my content analysis has a lot of Apple, PBS, iPod, and Dell. I don't know where it gets this topic summary.
What's your reach?
My true reach is 40.
40. Ah, oh, you beat me.
I know.
I got 12 clout, same as you, but I got 30 reach.
So, you know, check it out. Check out what it thinks about you on Twitter by going to clout.com. Hey, if you guys have a news, a follow-up, or web app you think we should look at, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. You can go to twitter.com/faceoffshow, email studio@faceoffshow.com. Either way, we'd love to hear from you guys. Let us know. As I asked before, what is your pocket configuration? Tell me what you put in which pocket, because you know there's going to be someone out there that's like, yeah, I put my cell phone in and my wallet in my back pocket, and I'm going to say you're crazy. I think that's crazy. You're a crazy man if you do that. So let us know. Let's get into our topic this week, which is disaster recovery.
Disaster. So
you know, it covers a lot of things, right, when you say disaster. I mean, in general, this is a web technology podcast, so I'll preface it with, you know, this, the majority of it's going to be about, you know, protecting your digital assets, but I do have to say, you know, analog preparation is important for disaster recovery. Make sure your documents are in a secure location, like a safety deposit box or a fire safe. Waterproof fire safe is always important. Really, I think the two big ones that most people need to worry about are things like fire and flood, you know, just those things that you can't really expect that just sort of happen and then all of a sudden your documents are ruined. But a really good tip is if you do have a bunch of documents and before you put them in your safety deposit box or someplace that is hard to reach, get digital scans of them and put them in an easy to use place. So things like your articles of incorporation will be handy for a meeting or something. If someone wants to see them, you can pull them up and print them. And you don't really need the originals for that. So, or you don't need them on your own
too.
Yeah, exactly. You can search for them, find them. But with that in mind, let's talk about protecting ourselves and disaster recovery for our digital assets.
All right. So you've got your analog preparation. You've got your papers scanned and whatnot. But if you scan them and you still have the flood and, you know, your hard drives are ruined, it didn't do you any good to digitize them. So the first question, I guess, is, you know, how fast can you get your site, meaning, you know, your business or your website or both, back up if, you know, Godzilla comes in and just breathes fire all over your workplace? Or that flood comes in, yeah, or a hurricane.
Go Godzilla.
Yeah. You know, how fast can you get it up? You know, does the thought of that scare you? Would you be like, oh, I'd be out of business tomorrow if that happened? We'd be out for a couple days.
Right.
You know, and so the second question is, what is that going to cost you?
Right.
And there's, you know, fancy names for this: recovery point objectives, you know, which is how much data we can afford to lose. There's recovery time objectives, how long can we spend getting it back? It basically boils down to, you know, what's it going to cost you if disaster strikes, whether it be flood or somebody went in and modified the Nginx config for your web browser and the site's down.
Oh, dear.
Is it going to cost you a couple hundred dollars a day? Is it going to cost you $1 million a minute in some cases, like Amazon or Google perhaps? So once you kind of figured that out, you can kind of, that's where you probably need to start in order to start thinking about the extensiveness you need to put into your disaster recovery plan. You know, are you going to have a computer sitting there, you know, with your physical assets ready to go in case the one goes down? Or are you going to have it kind of like in the back room on a hard drive or offsite where it's going to take a couple hours to get back, but it's okay because it's, you know, cheap because, you know, you don't, you know, you're not taking in millions of dollars per minute.
Right.
So what are the things we can do to back up our data? As far as like a website goes, full DB backups. There's different ways to do this. You can do, and this is kind of, so there's daily, monthly, weekly schedules you can do, whereas, you know, maybe you didn't notice there was a corruption error or something, you know, there, maybe you didn't notice the data was missing, so you need to go back a week or even a month, but you still need the daily stuff. So you kind of have to think about how much you need to back up and what, how often.
Right.
I've always kind of got stuck with the sync daily, then sync weekly, and then do a full backup monthly and keep the monthly backups for like 6 months or so.
Yeah.
Depending on, it also will kind of depend on the amount of data you have. One of the, I can't remember his, I'll get the guy's name in the show notes, but I think he worked with the Library of Congress for their backup stuff, and he came up with the 3-2-1 backup strategy, which is three copies of, in order, so in his definition, you don't have your data backed up unless you have these criteria met. And it's 3-2-1, three backup copies of not including the original. So you have the original, but you also have three different backups, two on different storage media. So that's like one on a hard drive, one on a CD or DVD or tape. And then one offsite, because if a flood, or, you know, a tsunami or something comes and just wipes out your whole place of business, you might not, you know, even if you have it backed up on tape drives and stuff, those might get damaged. So it's always good to have one offsite. You can use services like Amazon S3. You can encrypt it and send it off somewhere. You can take CDs and mail them off. You can sync them to a remote business location. You know, maybe you might maybe have different offices. You can you can sync between the two offices. As long as you can get it offsite. If we're talking about websites, you have your hosting offsite somewhere, either a VPS or a shared host. That's offsite, and you can also have your backup copy locally. So that's two different places. And then you might want to do another one and put it in your closet or something. Then you'll have three backups, two different media storage, and one offsite. and it's important to do that because you might think, you know, media can change. You know, you might have all these tapes, and then some tapes can expire. There's a lot of different things to happen there that can happen. So it's good to have two different types.
Yeah, that's a tough one because the more types you add, the more your costs sort of get higher. You know.
That's definitely true, and it might. I mean, depending on the mission criticalness of your app or your site or your business digital assets, you may or may not want to adhere to these rules, you know, super strict,
it's good advice. It's good things to think of. So this, if you get to the point where, you know, something is super critical and not, you know, all right, well, you know, I should put it on two mediums or two different mediums. You know, maybe I should take a clone of this hard drive and burn it to DVD or something and just store it so that, you know, if there's an EMP magnetic wave strike or something like that, then all your magnetic media is gone. At least you have a copy somewhere. It might not be the most up-to-date copy, but you have it somewhere, and it's not all lost.
Right. And, you know, these are the – I'm pretty sure – I'm gonna look it up and put it in the show notes, but I'm pretty sure this was for the advice given for the Library of Congress. So this is, you know, heart – I don't know. This is good, solid advice, but it might be overkill, as we've already said. You need to test your recovery plan on production at some level.
This is so important. Oh,
there's, you know, nobody wants to like test their failure plans on a live site, but you almost have to make sure everything is working. You don't have to take your site down. I mean, that's the whole idea of, if you can test your system and it doesn't break anything and your sites, your users don't have any ill effect, then you have a solid backup plan. If you can't, then you probably need to work on your disaster recovery plan. If it takes like, you know, too long to get this stuff back up, and a lot of stuff can be tested without interrupting your users. If it's failover stuff, you know, you have two lines of the internet coming into your server, or if it's RAID, like I have a Drobo and I can pull out a hard drive right now and it'll say, whoa, you know, there's only one hard drive in here, but I could get my data, and then I could, you know, plug it back in, and that's a valid test to see if what would happen if a hard drive failed in my Drobo. Would I have my digital assets?
Right. We always joke at work. We're working on trying to get some sort of large scale, you know, storage cloud stuff that we're kind of playing around with, and like the test for failover for us is, I mean, we're literally going to go back and unplug the machine. You know, we want to see no interruption of service when it happens.
It's kind of scary, and you should, I mean, make sure before you go and like start unplugging production stuff, make sure you have absolutely, you know, everything in place as far as you mm-hmm. can possibly tell. But then you need to test it on a production. Anything right. else is just academic, and you're just theorizing right. that it's going to work.
Well, and if you unplug that machine and it fails over great and there's no problem, you are going to sleep so much better at night. I mean, think about it. That's just, then it's a notification that it fails and you can go. It's not a notification that it fails and none of your users can get to their stuff. Oh my God.
Yep. And another very important thing is documentation of your infrastructure. So we oftentimes in the digital world, we're just thinking of backups as far as data. But sometimes things really go wrong and you need to start from scratch. You need to get your hosting business or your shared host goes out of business tomorrow for some reason, or, you know, something happens where you need to go in and rebuild your entire server from scratch. Let's say you have your MySQL dumps and your backups for your Rails project or your PHP project. You have all that stuff, but you don't know what modules you had installed. You don't know how your web server was configured, you know, your redirects or firewall settings. You know, you don't know any of this stuff. It might take you all day to redo all that or longer. But if you had it documented, you know, the IPs of the various machines, server configs, maybe put them in a Git repository or back those up some way. And also, I mean, maybe document them on how, you know, this is how you would set the server back up is if everything else failed.
Or an interesting thing that a lot of people don't think of is if you use a configuration management solution, such as like Chef or Puppet and you use just exclusively that, really your documentation is in the configuration, which is really nice because then it's, you know, if your server dies or something like that, then it's like, all right, well, the configuration part is pretty easy. Just spin up another instance, run this config on it. You know, so if you have the time or the means to do some sort of configuration management like that, it can really help in a situation like that.
Yeah, it might seem overkill to run Chef on a single machine, but if you ever needed to rebuild that server, Chef would just be excellent. You'd be up and running in no time.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's helpful to have readmes in certain folders that, you know, document what these files are for on the server or why they're there.
Right.
Installed software, whether it's plugins or, you know, is it Apache Nginx? Is it, you know, there's a command in most operating systems to get a list of the installed packages or programs, and so take advantage of those. You know, maybe set a cron job, right, just, you know, or daily thing that would just say the backup the list of applications you have installed. Or like you said, if you have Chef, you know, then it's kind of already there for you.
Or I mean, even little things like you don't think of right now, like if you're using like SMBFS or NFS to mount like a part of your file system, you know, to a remote server, it's like, that's the type of stuff, unless it's, you know, the only file mount on your thing, like it's hard to remember where that is, and all of a sudden, you know, you get the server back up and you just go, great, but you know, where's all my data? And you're like, oh, where was that mounted, and how do you know where does the mount exist exactly in the file system? And it can be really tough.
Very good point. I mean, or let's say there's some cron job that's absolutely critical for your app, but like the last time you looked at it was like 4 years ago because it just runs perfectly every day, and you don't even remember that you even did it.
Right,
and then your server goes down and you rebuild everything and you're like, why isn't this support request ticket system working? Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Because the cron is supposed to be, you know, doing that. So
yeah, exactly.
Those are the things you're going to want to have documented, especially the things that you set up once and forget about. Those are the ones you really need to look at as far as documentation, because they're going to be something you're going to forget. We already talked about this a little bit. You can store files on, if you're going to store digital assets, it's always best to use hardware or have hardware failure controls like RAID, mm-hmm, or on a SAN. Amazon S3 is a cloud service that is going to do that a little bit for you. I use Adrobo at home here.
We're actually going to use S3 to store our backups for AgileTask. So what I've been working on lately, one thing we did was I created a script that does, you know, grabs a database backup, you know, gets an rsync of all the web apps and all their files in the web app, and then basically I use Duplicity to store and encrypt that. And Duplicity has S3 integration built in, so if you're looking for something that's really easy to store something on S3, look at Duplicity. Really easy.
Very nice. I don't think, does Amazon have a clear policy of how many times your stuff is replicated?
No, I think
a very good track record.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they say specifically, but the whole point of the cloud is you shouldn't have to even think or worry about that, right? It, you know, they should have made the decision to make their cloud redundant enough for specific failovers so that you don't have to worry about it. And I believe Amazon has.
Yeah, I mean, they probably don't have a public policy of like how many times, but they definitely have the track record.
No, they only have a policy of telling you when their stuff fails, so you wouldn't even know if it did.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I've never really noticed Amazon ever failing.
No.
I mean, as far as their own site goes. Another thing to think about is monitoring and logging.
Totally.
You know, do you even know if your site goes down? How long would it take before you've noticed? There's scripts you can run. There's services that you can do, sign up for, that will just check to see if your website's up, or your file share, or whatever it is. Do you have monitoring there to know when it's going to go down?
Yeah.
Are you going to get an email or text message saying that your stuff's down?
Right.
Might be important to think about that. If it's
five critical. Five IMs from your friends saying, did you know the site's down? You're like, oh, crud.
So, and then why did it go down? You know, logging. Did somebody get in there and mess around with stuff?
Right.
Was there an error somewhere?
Did a tech trip over a power cord? Which is what happened to DreamHost, actually.
Really?
They went. It was funny. I was deploying a site for a client on DreamHost, and I talked up DreamHost because, I mean, I still really like DreamHost. I think DreamHost is a great bulk cheap host. And I was talking it up, so they finally signed up with DreamHost to do the site. We deploy it, and within the first like half an hour, it goes down. And it's down for like a half an hour. And oh God. And it was like the person that we were doing it with, she was like, why is it down? Oh no, this is terrible. Does this happen all the time? And I'm like, no, this doesn't happen that often at all, especially this long. And then later DreamHost did post on their blog that like one of their techs was back in the server room and tripped on a power cable and now plugged the server.
That is awesome.
In a bad way.
So yeah, those are some of the things you can think about. You know, depending on your risk of your downtime, you could write a huge long plan, or it could be as simple as, you know, let's make sure that we're backing up our database, our files, and sending them off to Amazon S3.
Right. I mean, it like so. For example, let's use this for example. If we really needed to, like, you know, if Agile Task went down, getting it, you know, I really don't need to grab all the files and stuff. I just want to because it's easier. Really, I mean, all I need to get Agile Task back up is some server that will run Rails. I use Nginx right now, which was kind of a pain to configure for me, but I could have done it Apache and Passenger and, you know, no problem. But really, you know, like the key to that web app is the data, right? The MySQL database dump. That is the really important part. We have all our code in GitHub, you know, so if that, you know, it's safe there in some way. So really, if I had to, I could just get a server up with Apache Passenger, you know, and then just do a MySQL dump and it would be back up. I don't want to do that. But also we have double failover as well because with Linode, I pay for backup. So I have a monthly, weekly, and a nightly full VM backup from Linode. So really the database dump and stuff is sort of like a last ditch, you know, Linode's data center crashes into the ocean. So, I mean, I think we're pretty secure, but that's something you need to gauge, right? Because, you know.
Well, yeah. But you might want to have a MySQL dump that's more up to date than a day ago, and then use maybe Linode's for, you know, if there's an update went wrong or something,
right.
And you wanted to go back, but then you take your MySQL dump and you feed it in.
Right.
So you have the most up to date user data, but you're using an older VM version.
Right. And I mean, gauge your risk of your data loss. I mean, if I'm doing sort of financial data, every transaction is very important. So I'm going to do like backups or have like triple redundancy on my database as they're, you know, the transactions are occurring just in case. But you know, if you're just doing like, this is my recipe website, you know, once a week, probably pretty safe, you know?
Definitely. That's why the first step is definitely check out what your risk is. Right. I mean, how much is it going to cost you and how much can you afford to lose? Right.
But you need to be thinking about it no matter what. I think a lot of people don't. I really didn't put much thought into it when I purchased for the Linode backups. But then we were thinking, you know, it's, you know, probably smart now that we have a production app up to get a second method in there. So think about your disaster recovery. And again, we cannot stress this enough. Test it, test it, test it. We're going to be testing here sometime soon to make sure if something did happen, we could get back up and running. So make sure you do that. It's important to do. That wraps it up for this episode of Face Off. I want to thank you guys for listening. If you haven't subscribed to the show yet, go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe. We'd love to hear from you. And you can also leave feedback for the show, like telling us what you guys do for backup. What are the cool things you use? I know there's a lot of cool desktop backup software out there. I've used Time Machine a little bit, but there's other cloud-based ones like Backburner and stuff. Let me know what you guys are using for your web apps, what you guys use to backup. Really want to hear what you guys are doing as well as your pocket configurations for the stuff in your pocket. So let us know. Tweet us out. Send us an email. Love to hear from you guys. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.